This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. As many of you know, it's sports season, right? And this is the time when everything comes together, right? We have football, basketball will be starting pretty soon. We have baseball getting ready for playoffs. We have the WNBA ready for playoffs. So there's a lot going on. This evening, I'll be on the sideline for UConn football as they take on Florida Atlantic University. So if you are there and you have a chance to come on down and say hello. And that game starts at 7 p.m. Last week, I had a great opportunity, which was to get down to Yankee Stadium and to take care of some things there. But among the things I did, I got to bring my 7-year-old grandson along with me. And it reminds me, as many of you will remember, the excitement, the wonderment of going to your first professional sports event. I remember it so clearly. Again, it was Yankee Stadium because I grew up in the Bronx, but just that wonderment and being able to share that with a grandchild. So it was a great experience overall. Today, our show, I have a great guest coming on, Dr. Stefan Kachala. Dr. Kachala is the chief of thoracic surgery and the chair of St. Francis's Robotic Steering Committee. So we're going to be talking about thoracic surgery, but we're going to be talking specifically about lung cancer and some of the innovative treatments for lung cancer and some of the factors that have played into it. Where are we with the treatment of lung cancer, especially since we've really stepped up restrictions on smoking? And now we're trying to really emphasize that to young people because those are that's the generation we need to be emphasizing. So we'll be talking with Dr. Kachala in the second half of the program. If you have questions you'd like me to ask him or any questions for the program, you can reach me live today at info@alessimd.com. This day in medicine, on September 21st, 1507, they had a major breakout of a disease called pseudor angelicus, or sweating sickness, and it broke out in London. Now, the sweating sickness is something I had no idea of, and spent some time with that. And basically, it's a mysterious disease of unknown origin. The first epidemic occurred in 1485 and the last one in 1551, where it seems to just disappeared suddenly. And it was interesting because it results in sudden death within hours of the onset. And it comes on with this sense of apprehension. And there was a great description of it written in the past, but unfortunately there were no samples. There was no real workup to be done back at that time. But there was this sense of apprehension, and from someone would get shivering, coldness, dizziness, headache, neck pain, exhaustion, and they would die. It was also interesting because it occurred primarily in a rural setting. So at that time, most epidemics occurred in urban settings, but in this case, it was really a rural setting where people were affected and passed on. And it was particularly prone for males. But again, it would be sudden death in hours. And as I contemplated that and these symptoms, I started thinking about encephalitis, something that rapidly affects the brain, either viral or an infection. Matter of fact, I had a situation this week where I got a telephone call. I often get calls from professional athletes, broadcast people who I've had contact with or seen as patients, and now they have relatives or friends in need of consultation somewhere along the way and somewhere in the country. And in this particular case, it was a young man who developed what seemed like a viral meningitis, something we see a great deal of in the fall when the viral titers are high for Echo and Coxsackie virus. And what happened was his body reacted against the virus, but it overreacted. And you'll see that sometimes, especially in young people. So your immune system goes into overdrive in attacking the virus. And in addition to that, it attacks healthy tissue in the brain and spinal cord. So now you've gone from a situation where you want your immune system to attack the virus, and now you've got to put the brakes on. And you do that with the use of IVIG, and in this case, the addition of steroids. Fortunately, within several days, now this child became quite ill and had to be in an ICU, could not move any limbs, and was kind of comatose or semi-comatose and obtunded. But responded very well to the medication and went home. So it got me thinking about that when we hear something about the sweating sickness. Another thing that happened this date in medicine, this time I thought we'd discuss two of them. On September 21st, 1948, Dr. Philip Showalter Henck and Dr. Edward Kendall, along with a Swiss chemist, Thaddeus Reichstein, these people won the Nobel Prize. And it was because that in 1948, they used cortisone, right? So cortisone being a hormone from the adrenal glands, they injected it to someone with rheumatoid arthritis. And that was the first time it was done in 1948. And in fact, it was done. They were both physicians at the Mayo Clinic. And again, it gets you thinking about how many steroid injections are carried out every day in this country. And I'm sure many of our listeners today have had that done. I've had it done myself where for a particular type of joint pain. And steroid medication like cortisone immediately brings down the inflammation and allows the joint to function normally. And when doing so, it allows it to move more freely. Again, these steroid medications have been around so long, and yet they are still the hallmark of treatment for a lot of different types of arthritis. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to talk about a variety of topics. I also have a question from a listener that I really want to get to. So we'll take a short break. If you have questions for me or for my guest who will be joining us, Dr. Stefan Kachala, you can reach us at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And I always like when I get questions from listeners. And this one came in this week from Mark. And it was about a new product called NuPro. And it's not that new. It's been around a few years. It's spelled N-E-U-P-R-O. And NuPro is a delivery system, actually, for a drug called ritagatine. And ritagatine is a dopamine agonist. So this particular drug is used for people with Parkinson's disease and restless leg syndrome. So this was in particular to how effective NuPro is for restless leg syndrome. So let me go back. So we have the drug, ritagatine, but it also needs to be delivered. And in this case, it's delivered transdermally. So a patch, so that the administration is fairly consistent over the course of a day. So you would put the patch on, and that's how you would receive the medication rather than taking a pill intermittently. So the question was about, did I have any thoughts about this particular medication as a treatment for restless leg syndrome? Now, when you hear the two terms, it's treating Parkinson's disease and restless leg syndrome, you think the two things are related. They are related only in terms of treatment because, as you'll remember, Parkinson's disease is due to a depletion of dopamine in the brain, right? And it results in tremor, difficulty with gait, so inability to keep your balance, what we call bradykinesia as well, moving more slowly with a flexed posture. So when you see those symptoms, again, you start thinking of Parkinson's disease, this rigidity, this stiff type of movement, as opposed to restless leg, which is where you have this tremendous feeling that you have to get up and walk. It interferes with your sleep during the night, where you have to get up, walk around intermittently, and it could affect a patient four or five, maybe more times in a night, interfering with sleep. Well, anyhow, so NuPro is a patch you put on, and you can then absorb this dopamine agonist. I put the question to Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez. Dr. Rodriguez, as you know, is a frequent guest on our program who treats movement disorders, among them Parkinson's disease and restless leg syndrome. And his impression was that he's used the product more for Parkinson's disease than restless leg. And the thing to be aware of is some people have trouble with the adhesive because either it doesn't stick or sometimes it will cause a skin irritation. But he's found that it's worth trying as a delivery system. He does use gabapentin or Mirapex and the more traditional medications, Requip as well. So the question really is, first of all, there's nothing wrong with using it. It is not universally accepted for some patients because they get irritation of the skin, but certainly worth a shot for what could be very debilitating in restless leg syndrome. So, Mark, I hope that answers your question, and I think we've all learned something by that. You know, while we're on the subject of unique delivery systems, the flu vaccine has been able to be administered through a nasal spray. You know, it's not a traditional nasal spray for those of you who have seen it, especially administering it in children. It's more like a syringe with an adapter at the end, but it's administered intranasally, and that's how you can get the antibodies for the flu. So particularly used for people who have an aversion to needles and in children. Well, now the FDA has approved the fact that you can get this flu mist nasal spray at your pharmacy and administer it at home. So you can do self-administration. In order to administer it, you have to be over the age of 18. And it's a way of making a vaccine more convenient for everybody. And that's what we really want to do with flu season coming up and increase those rates. So basically, they supply the vaccine through a third-party pharmacy, and people have to complete a screening assessment to determine if they're candidates for getting the flu vaccine. So, again, you can now do that at home, and I believe it could be mailed to you or it's picked up at a pharmacy. I would check with a pharmacist with respect to how to go about doing that. Last weekend, I did my biannual basic life support and advanced cardiac life support class. And we did it last Sunday, did it along with other members of my family who are physicians. So every 2 years, we're required to be recertified in basic life support and advanced cardiac life support. And I always find that interesting because things change in terms of chest compressions and in advanced cardiac life support. What we're really studying about is the administration of medications if someone has a heart attack or some other cardiac failure. As part of basic life support now, in the last few years, it has been also learning how to use a defibrillator, an external defibrillator, and that is very important and very life-saving. People should learn, everyone should learn how to use those, how to find one and use it, because it is obviously very much life-saving for people. You can't mess it up. It's not a situation where you can shock someone and hurt them in some way, because the machine tells you if it's appropriate to shock. If they do not have the appropriate rhythm to shock, it won't work. So it's a very interesting thing. But what struck me now was how much we use Narcan and how important it is to have Narcan available. In fact, one of my daughters shared with us that on a physician group, they're recommending when you send your child off to college, you send them with Narcan. Now, Narcan is the antidote for an opiate overdose. Now, not to say that your child is using opiates. Let's bear that in mind. The thinking has been that the use of fentanyl and other narcotics is so widespread that it's not uncommon to have someone put that in a drink if they're out. And if they don't mind their drink, meaning keep an eye on it, someone could easily put that in there and could result in death because no one knows the actual potency of fentanyl. So they recommend that when you send your child off to college, you send them with Narcan. And Narcan can be obtained from any pharmacy. You do not need a prescription for it now, because, again, it is a life-saving antidote. Boy, have we come a long way, that's for sure, in sending our children off to college. Something to bear in mind. One last thing I wanted to touch on was hearing aids. I heard the folks at Computer Talk, they were on with Brian this week, talking about the technology behind hearing aids. And we've been discussing it on this program. Much like AirPods, those Apple devices you put in your ear, again, hearing aids. If you need a hearing aid, get one. It is the number one modifiable risk factor for dementia. And it's hearing loss that will often lead to isolation and accelerate symptoms of dementia. They are much less expensive. You don't need a prescription anymore. If you want to test your hearing, there is an app called Mimi, M-I-M-I, and you can do that on a smartphone or on a computer. Test your hearing. You will get numbers, and you'll get an idea of whether or not you need a hearing aid and what it needs to be. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Stefan Kachala, and we're talking about thoracic surgery and lung cancer. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you. And with my guest today, Dr. Stefan Kachala. Stefan is the chief of thoracic surgery and chair of the St. Francis Robotic Steering Committee here at St. Francis Hospital and part of Trinity Health of New England. He's also medical director of the St. Francis Lung Screening Program. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Tony, thanks so much for having me today.
Hey, listen, let's get right into it here. And can you explain to our listeners a little bit about your background and what has it taken to become a thoracic surgeon?
Well, that's a great place to start. It's been a long road. I started with, obviously, high school and college like everyone else. Had a desire to kind of interest in science, and that led me to medical school, where I did take a little bit of a break. I spent 2 years at the National Institutes of Health down in Bethesda, Maryland, where I got to really pique my interest in cancer and understanding what the surgical ways of approaching that is, studying under Dr. Labuti as well as Dr. Steve Rosenberg at the Cancer Institute and Department of Surgery. Taking that, I ended up starting in general surgery, where I also spent another 2 years where I was at Memorial Sloan Kettering as a thoracic surgery research fellow, and further kind of honed that interest under excellent mentors like Valerie Roush, who was the chair of thoracic surgery at that time, as well as Dr. Addison Milley, who really piqued my interest in immunotherapy as well. And then over to the Cleveland Clinic, where I trained in cardiothoracic surgery with a focus on thoracic surgical oncology and thoracic surgery. And then I was able and fortunate to bring my skills here and settle down in Connecticut.
You know, Stefan, I'm laughing because when I talk to young people about what they want to do, and a lot of times people say, well, I'd like to be a doctor, but I don't know. It just takes so long.
It does take a long time. You're absolutely right.
It does take a long time, especially when you become highly specialized and skilled, such as a thoracic surgeon and such as yourself. But I always tell them that it pays off in the long run. I know that you and others and people like myself have such great job satisfaction in what we do, and the rewards are so great. So I try to encourage them to hang in with it, but it is daunting when you're looking at it from that end. But
you're right,
specifically,
when we,
go ahead.
I would just interject. It's when we're able to take care of patients and work hard that increases our, you know, satisfaction, because that's what we've trained to do, is to bring those services to our patients.
It does, and I try to tell them it's not like going to school. It's really very rewarding as you move through. But what does a thoracic surgeon do as opposed to the cardiothoracic side? Because over the years, that's become really two separate specialties right now.
You know, if you ask the associations and, like, why do we still have to do both, right? Why is it still cardiothoracic? And that, as the training still is. And it's because there's still a lot of parts in the country that need surgeons who can do both roles. But you're absolutely right. There's a large desire to focus in and subspecialize so that as a practitioner, you're not really bringing more generalistic skills, but focus skills to have the best outcomes. Our cardiac surgeons nowadays, especially those at Trinity, we're focused on that every single case is perfect. There are no poor outcomes, that everyone who comes in, they leave much better than what they came in with. And now with thoracic surgery, we've just separated off from the cardiac. So I myself did train to do open heart surgery. I no longer do that, because the focus of my training was this general thoracic and oncologic surgery. So what does it mean? It means I basically do everything in the chest aside from the heart and great vessels. So mostly it's a focus of cancer surgery, but I work on the airway and the trachea. I work on the lungs. I work on the esophagus. I work on the other organs around the chest, that is the thymus, which is the sac in front of the heart. I work on tumors that can be anywhere. I also help repair the ribs on trauma patients. So again, it's kind of like everything in there, with the exception of the heart and great vessels, because that discipline requires a lot of focus. And then what I do is take things that used to be very complex. How do we manage those patients so that they're home faster, they're back in course of their lives, and the quality of their life is increased, which wasn't always the case with thoracic surgery in its long history.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit before we get into cancer, because you mentioned the trachea. And, you know, years ago, right, there was, I guess, for lack of a better term, a hoax where they said that they could rebuild an entire trachea from stem cells. And I think it got, in the end, was a lot of bad press. Can you clarify that situation and where we are with reconstructing someone's trachea?
So that story that you alluded to is the story of this unfortunate Italian surgeon who really rose to high, high visibility with these incredible promises and was promised lots of money. And it was actually, I think, either a CBS or 60 Minutes story even. And I actually personally knew some of the surgeons who were the first to kind of raise their hand and say, nothing, this isn't what it seems. And what happened was with that story was that he actually never had good results. Many patients suffered at his hands, and unfortunately, it's kind of called into question the exact things that you're bringing. Now, where I trained, the tracheal surgery, essentially what we do is, if you have a tumor in your trachea, we cut it out and sew it back together. It's as simple as that. What he was presenting as being to replace the entire trachea with stem cells, which never came to fruition. There's still a lot of intensive research to be done in that field. But I recently, in the last, actually it was in January this year, was fortunate to take care of a person with a tracheal cancer, and we were able to resect it and get her home in 3 to 6 days. And with that, her life is back on track. She's actually stopped smoking as well, and that was fantastic. But the main issue is that this is something that we can offer nowadays. It doesn't actually just have to be in high-volume centers, but the patients are highly selected. We want to encourage them and work with them, but the field of thoracic surgery is taking these highly complex operations, and how do we dress for patients where they are and then help them get back to their lives and on track?
I'm glad you clarified that. But how big a problem is lung cancer in the United States right now? I know we've made some strides with restricting smoking since the 60s and things such as that. But where are we? How big a problem are we facing here?
You know, we've made a lot of great strides, Tony. You're absolutely right. But if you look at the dent we've made in it, it doesn't seem to have really registered yet. Smoking is still the leading cause of cancer deaths, with over 220,000 people dying of lung cancer every year. And if you look worldwide, it's even worse. I mean, there's 2.5 million cases of lung cancer. The vast, vast majority is still associated with smoking. So, you know, we still have a lot of work to do. We're looking at the models. We see the screening and the huge impact that the practitioners who take care of breast cancer patients have been able to achieve, and colon cancer. But there's still a lot of work to be done in all these fields. But we're modeling lung cancer after the success we've seen in those other fields, and we're trying to bring it to bear, most notably with the advent of screening for lung cancer. So those people who have been smoking for greater than 20 years and over 50 years of age are eligible for lung cancer screening. Unfortunately, we're still really trying to get the word out. If you look nationwide, the last data that we really have is saying that only 3%, so 3 out of 100 people who are eligible are actually getting the scan. A little better in Connecticut. We're approaching, or maybe I think we've just crossed over the 10% threshold. But a lot of people are eligible for these scans, and we want to get into them. Why? So we can intervene earlier and reduce their cancer risk, or even cure them of cancer and get them back on their lives.
So let's go over the specifics so our listeners will know, and they could share it with people. So who is qualified? You said smoking for over 20. Is that it? Is it the amount of smoking they did for that period of time? Are there other factors that play into it, like age or other conditions? Who specifically is eligible to have, and I'm assuming we're talking about CT scans as a screening tool for lung cancer?
Yeah, so if we look at, you know, patients who are eligible, right now the criteria is very on the narrow side, or broad, depending on your perspective. It is patients who have been smoking for more than 20 years, who quit less than 10 years ago, and are over the age of 50. And that's basically a very, very broad net. Now, if you look at who's at risk for lung cancer, it tends to peak around 70 years of age, regardless of whether or not you smoked or not. So we do know there's people at risk. The problem is, if we just scan everybody at the age of 70, there's the vast, vast majority, over 99% of patients are not going to have lung cancer. However, that's the reason for throwing a net around smokers who are at elevated risk. And then it's under the discussion of a focus, either a pulmonary practitioner, like a pulmonary medicine doctor, or a thoracic surgeon, to determine what are the next steps when we find a lung nodule. Because, again, the vast majority of people do just have benign lung nodules. But the reason that we know this is that with the research we've done, we see that CT, low-dose CT screening of the chest in smokers does improve and increase their overall survival.
Now, we talked about the 220,000 deaths in this country, and you talked about the worldwide numbers, but smoking is rampant around the rest of the world. I mean, if you go to Asia, you go to Europe. I was recently in Europe and was shocked that I was in a restaurant where there was a cigarette machine. I actually had to take a picture of it, okay? Because I hadn't seen one in years, and my children and grandchildren certainly haven't seen a cigarette machine, you know, that said Winston on it, where you pull the handle out and a pack of cigarettes came out. Why are they so far behind us?
You know, it's a cultural thing. It's also the notion of choice and how to intervene. And, you know, in some countries, the notion of medicine as terms of improving life rather than something that you fall back on, I think it's the cultural approaches to it. You know, it maybe doesn't come as such surprise in that the smoking in China is far, far more prevalent than the United States. And granted, they do have a larger population, but the number of new cases of lung cancer per annum in China is over a million compared to us in the low, you know, hundreds of thousands. And that's just simply the increase of number of people who smoke in the population. You know, in the United States, what we are often faced with is the stigma around smoking and being diagnosed with smoking-related diseases. And in the medical field, we're really trying to, these are the people that we really know we can make the greatest improvements to their life and reaching them and making sure they're getting the appropriate care they need, not only with lung cancer and other manifestations, but then we look at the people, Tony, who don't smoke and get lung cancer. And, you know, it's still a risk. In fact, over 20% of patients with lung cancer never smoked a day in their life. And that's why we see people who get these incidental CAT scans. Oh, they're in a car accident. Oh, they just have a cough and their pulmonologist on a whim ordered a CAT scan and we find a lung nodule that ends up being cancer. So it's a lot of education, both abroad with, you know, their medical fields, but in the United States as well. And how do we get people plugged in? How do we reduce that time from the identification to getting the identification of what it is? And then how do we get them treated?
I'm glad you touched on the non-smokers who get lung cancer, because it's very interesting, because sometimes when you hear somebody has lung cancer, you automatically assume they were smokers. And yes. People are quick to qualify that. So-and-so got lung cancer, never smoked. But my question is this, is that do you find sometimes that those cancers, lung cancers in non-smokers, is there a difference in terms of their aggressiveness? Are non-smokers who get lung cancer, do they die sooner or do they get sicker? Is there any data for that?
There's a lot of data. And just at first blush, we do feel that the lung cancer that appears in non-smokers, because of the different mutations we feel, tends to be more aggressive. And so, again, we are tend to be more aggressive in our therapy for those patients as well. Unfortunately, because they're non-smokers, sometimes medical physicians were not as going to lung cancer first like we are in a smoker. Oh, we got to rule out lung cancer in this smoker. But in a non-smoker, we're trying to think of, you know, what's our differential diagnosis? What else could it be? And so sometimes in non-smokers, there's a little bit of a delay in the diagnosis. And that's what we work together as a multidisciplinary team to really reduce that time from diagnosis to treatment as much as possible. But yeah, in a broad brushstroke, yes, we do feel and see that in non-smokers, it tends to be more aggressive.
We've talked a little bit about the diagnostics, but what about the treatment? How has the treatment changed? And specifically, I'm glad you did work in immunotherapy because it's something that fascinates me and we talk about often on this program with respect to brain tumors, melanoma, and other cancers where immunotherapy is the cutting edge. So can you talk a little bit about treatment in general and specifically immunotherapy?
Right, absolutely. So I think just if there's one message that I would like all your listeners to take home is that the treatment of lung cancer in the last 10 years has been completely revolutionary, undergone a change. It is something where 10 years ago or more when I was in medical school, the notion that you had stage 4 lung cancer was something you need to put your affairs in order 3 to 6 months of life left. Nowadays, I can talk to multiple medical oncologists, thoracic surgeons who say, I have a stage 4 patient who has been living with lung cancer for over 10 years because of these treatments. Revolutionary changes. Now, how does it work? What is it done? Well, if we look into the more advanced stages, immunotherapies are typically infusions of different antibodies and targeted therapies that act to, essentially, you can think of lung cancer works as, think of a masquerade party where everyone's wearing a mask or some sort of disguise. And you know there's party crashers. They're known as the people at the party want to throw out. Well, these immunotherapies essentially rip off the mask, a.k.a. like Scooby-Doo, so that the gate crashers can be thrown out of the party. The lung cancer can be exposed, destroyed, and gotten out of your body. And it takes your own immune system to be able to attack them because they're hiding from your immune system. And there are side effects. It's potent therapy, but it has been extending people's lives. And that's just, there's no other way to get around it. In fact, I will say, as a thoracic surgeon, some of the earlier trials were very concerning to us because they showed better results, and these were patients who did not get surgery. So it made us very nervous, Tony. We're all of a sudden worried about our jobs, but there's a lot of impact, and we're seeing that surgery, at least in the early trials that do incorporate immunotherapy and surgery together, is of great benefit, even longer survival. So still a multidisciplinary approach to lung cancer. It's no longer, you know, the lone ranger surgeon out there taking care of patients. Yep. Coordinated care amongst your physicians is the standard of care, so that we're coming together as a team. I know I'm talking to my partners in medical oncology, interventional pulmonary radiation oncology, multiple times a day. We sometimes have a running group chat where we're discussing the patients. Sometimes we're even in the same room discussed. Sometimes it's virtual, so that the patients get the benefit of all our minds, bringing to bear all the latest research that we've all read about, to know that they're getting, you know, kind of the best outstanding care they deserve.
I'm glad you stressed that team approach, and I want people to understand that. Like when we tumor board somebody, they're getting not just one opinion. But one of your jobs is in robotic surgery. And
yes.
I want to go back to that. And can you explain robotic surgery so that folks can understand it and exactly how you use it in the treatment of lung cancer?
Of course. So robotics have kind of come into both the diagnostic part with bronchoscopy, but also with the therapeutic part with surgery. And I think that easiest way to understand it is thinking about, if anyone's ever seen a robotic arm or at a factory where the robots really help us assemble cars, except for one simple fact, is that the surgeon is completely controlling that arm. There is no self-programmed or, you know, autonomous work. The surgeon controls it. So it can almost be an extension of their own arms and hands in this device that increases the precision, increases the visibility, and thus the accuracy of the procedure. Now, it goes to the surgeon working to identify the patients how to leverage that technology to get better outcomes. So with regards to using the Intuitive Da Vinci system in my own practice, we've worked and developed protocols so that the patient, whereas before, you know, as recent as 5 years ago, although in some places in the country still this way, patients may spend 5 to 7 days in the hospital after a lobectomy. That's where we take out the part of the lung that has the lung cancer in it. And nowadays, I tell my patients, the expectation that you should have for yourself is to be able to go home the next day. So taking something 5 to 7 days in the hospital, where you should be able to go home the next day. And the, you know, vast majority of my patients usually go home the day after the surgery. And how have we done that? Well, it's the small incisions in cameras, the high precision, the low blood loss, and the decreased pain allows us to get the chest tubes and everything out, so the patient wants to go home the next day. And it takes, you know, a lot of education, setting of those expectations, working together as a team, the protocols we have with anesthesia, and then the pain control afterwards to get that patient home. And that's where it really comes in, that we're leveraging this technology to help the patient be more comfortable, be more active, and get on track with recovery sooner.
I think that's just a great explanation, because there are still people out there who think C3PO is doing their surgery and you're having a cup of coffee. So.
Yeah, not yet. It's still the skill of the surgeon, absolutely.
Okay, you still need to be there. Well, let's, you know, we've touched on a lot of different things here, but what's the one thing our audience should be aware of now in regard to the treatment of lung cancer and where we're heading in the future, Stefan?
I think whenever people hear they have a lung tumor, they have a lung cancer, the fears of the history of lung cancer just start building up. The, oh, my uncle this, my father this. The treatment has radically changed. We have a team approach. We have so many more tools at our disposal. Surgery has gone from being something that leaves people hobbled in pain and shortening their life to extending it and being able to achieve that high quality of life that you had before surgery. So if there's one thing I want all your listeners to take home at, the treatment of lung cancer has revolutionary change. We're looking to preserve your quality of life, and we have the tools to do that. Work with your doctors because we want to be there for you and, you know, and serve you to the best of our abilities. But, Tony, I really appreciate the time to be with you today.
Thank you so much. And if any of our listeners want to reach out to Dr. Kachala, the telephone number is 860-714-5237. Stefan, thank you for today, and thank you for all you do for our community.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tony. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board, as always, with Jeff Chandler in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. And many thanks to our guest today, Dr. Stefan Kachala from St. Francis Hospital. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.